Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A brutal serial killer was stalking Omaha, but who would kill with such precision? Detective Derek Moyse wasn't sure what he was dealing with when in March 2008, he walked into a home in an affluent Omaha neighborhood and was confronted with the bodies of an 11-year-old boy and the housekeeper. Both had been murdered with kitchen knives plunged into their throats. Who would do something so vile and why? Lacking answers, Moyse and other detectives working the case were stumped. 5 years later, a strikingly similar crime occurred in which two more victims were brutally murdered with knives expertly thrust into their jugular veins. The modus operandi of the murders pointed Moyse and a special task force in the direction of looking for a serial killer. But no one could have anticipated that path would lead to the Department of Pathology at Creighton University. In Pathological, The Murderous Rage of Dr. Anthony Garcia, authors Henry J. Cordes and Todd Cooper, who covered the story for the Omaha World Herald, recount the dramatic tale of deep-seated revenge, determined detectives, and the sensational trial of the doctor-turned-serial killer. The book that we're featuring this evening is Pathological, The Murderous Rage of Dr. Anthony Garcia, with my special guest journalist and author, Henry J. Cordes. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Henry J. Cordes.
No, Dan, thanks for having me. I'm glad to join you from out here in Omaha.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible tale of doctor-turned-serial killer and some dedicated detectives that brought this man to justice, finally. We talked about your background with the Omaha, the Omaha, Nebraska Journal.
Omaha World Herald is the name of our paper, right.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I know this was a big case, but why did you feel it necessary? Why did you want to write this book? What was it about this case that made you, compelled you to write this?
Yeah, it originally wasn't going to be a book. I'll give you the background of how it all came about. The day that Garcia was arrested, I was at the press conference where the police chief announced it and the task force announced it. And afterwards, I followed the chief back to his office. I was just a reporter covering the case for the World Herald. I followed him back to his office just to kind of get some, try to pump him for some extra information that would be exclusive just for our readers. But I asked him that very day. I said, when all this is over, would you be willing to make your detectives available for interview about how this case was cracked? I didn't even know at the time who those detectives were, but I just had a sense that there would be an amazing story there. And my plan was wasn't to write a book, but to write a multi-part narrative for the newspaper. I soon after sketched out what I thought would be like an 8-part narrative. It would run from a Sunday to a Sunday in our daily newspaper. But once the trial was over and once I got to sit down with those detectives, the tale was so truly amazing and detailed that once I started to sit down and writing it, I told my editor, this isn't just a series for the paper, this is a book. And it did. It turned out to be like 52,000 words worth of the tale of Anthony Garcia.
Absolutely. You start off with the reader immediately introducing some of these detectives that you have access to, and especially Detective Derek Moyse. And you open with him just coming to the crime scene of 11-year-old Tom Hunter that we talked about in the introduction, and that Shirley Sherman, who is a housekeeper for the family, for the Hunter family. So tell us about Detective Derek Moyse and what he finds, and tell us a little bit more about the home in which this murder occurs and who the owners are.
Yeah, where this murder occurs, it's in a very affluent older neighborhood in Omaha, and the home is the home of the husband and wife doctors, and Derek Moise, he's just the nighttime detective on the homicide squad, and so the bodies are discovered around 5 o'clock, and so he just happens to be assigned to it. But it's the first of just many remarkable instances where Derek Moise just happens to be the guy on the spot when important things occur in this case. So he's the first detective to walk in the door. He walks in. There's some cleaning supplies set out in front of him, just kind of casually set down there. And then off right to his to the left is the body of an 11-year-old boy with a knife. Not only had he been stabbed in the neck, the knife had been left in his neck. And so extreme. And he continues the case. That he walks into the kitchen just beyond where the boy is, sees a knife block on the counter. He recognizes right away that from the stainless steel handles, this is the knife, this is the block from which that knife came from. And he knows that there are two bodies in the home. And after he goes through the kitchen, he comes upon the second body, the housekeeper, also with a knife with a stainless steel handle still stuck in her neck. And, you know, this is a detective who, you know, Omaha has its share of homicides, but this is a detective that's used to dealing with, you know, gang-related shootings and drug-related crime. And so he just sees right away, this is a huge departure from anything I've ever encountered. And the knife wounds in the neck particularly baffled them, and in fact they would baffle him and all of the detectives for the next 5 years.
You talk about what the police deduce quick enough in terms of speaking to William Hunter and his
right.
wife Claire. So what do they find out in terms of what likely happened? Even though they still don't have an idea of motive or any rationale to this thing, what can they determine from speaking to the parents in terms of timeline and what likely happened there from
right.
what they look at as
right.
crime scene?
Yeah, Tom was a latchkey kid. He was 11-year-old in the seventh grade. He'd get off his bus right in front of the home there at 3 o'clock, and we know he did. We have a video of from the bus that shows that happen, and they typically would enter the house and just do his thing. We know in this case he went down, he grabbed a Dr. Pepper and went down and was playing video games, because at the time his body was discovered by his father 2 hours later, the video game was still on. In fact, Bill Hunter referred to it as that awful music, you know, the background music of the video game that was playing.
Right.
So Dr. Hunter came home around 5 o'clock, which, as we now know, was about 2 hours after the murders, because it was not long after Tom came home that their neighbors reported seeing a man, an olive-skinned man, drive up the street, kind of like he was scoping out addresses, pause in front of the Hunter home, continue around the corner, park, make his way to the home very casually. About a half hour later, around 3:30, equally very casually walking away, and the man had been driving a silver CRV, and so that's pretty much all they had at that point. We know it's an olive-skinned man in a silver CRV. Nobody had a license plate. They thought that it was an out-of-state plate, but that's all they had to go on, and just the extremity of these types of murders. And part of the problem that the detectives faced right away was they didn't even know who the intended victim was. You know, was it Tommy himself, the boy? Was it the housekeeper? Was it the Hunter parents? And because there was no clear motive, police ended up looking in a lot of different areas. And the housekeeper had some in her family, there was some history of drug use, and she had been having a big conflict with her daughter's boyfriend, and there had been some physical violence associated with him. And so the police kind of, that was kind of the natural first place they looked, because there was a, there did appear to be a violent individual there. There had been a murder the previous year that happened in Omaha where a woman was stabbed to death. And in that case, the knife had been left in her neck, and which was just a very unusual thing. No one in Omaha could ever recall any case where that had happened, let alone two in a year. And so that case was, and they had a suspect in that case who had not yet been arrested. And so they probed ties he may have had to anyone there in the house. And then the hunters, of course, were asked about patients and folks they worked with. And in fact, they were questioned many times early on about that. And Bill Hunter in particular, he just could not imagine anybody he had ever worked with or had ever known who could have done something like this. He just felt he had had no conflicts with anybody recently. Now there were some other folks in the Creighton Pathology Department, which is where he worked, and there were some other folks who were suspected a doctor who had been in the program a couple of years earlier, who was of Russian background, and who had been seen as kind of creepy variously. There were some people who thought he was a little bit shifty. And so he was a suspect who many, Bill Hunter didn't even think he was a suspect either, but several others at Creighton did. And he ended up getting a good look. But, you know, of those three primary suspects early on, the violent boyfriend, the guy who had, who they believed had committed a similar murder, and this Russian doctor, they were all pretty heavily vetted and they went nowhere. They didn't get, they, in all cases, they found that either these people had an alibi for the time of the murders, and they were pretty stumped. And after a while, they started focusing on Tommy's interaction in video gaming and online to think whether he had, you know, this could have been some type of internet crime. And they looked a lot into his interactions, and they found some interactions that concerned them. And with some folks, including in an online chat room where he was interacting with a guy who was much older. You know, this is a website that was for preteens, and he was interacting with a guy who turned out was in college, and you know, much older than the. And so it was like, what is this college guy doing in this chat room? He was being vetted. There were a lot of different ways that they looked early on, but all of them led nowhere. And within a year, the case was cold, was transferred to the cold case unit. They followed up on stuff, relooked at stuff, but to the great frustration of everyone in Omaha, the original case just didn't get anywhere.
Let's talk about when they look at a possible motive. Was there any indication of robbery or burglary? And then second, the feature, one of the very interesting, unique things, is how severe were those and significant were those stabs to the throat, and what was the, right, they were characterized by? These were not, they looked like the work of someone more expert in terms with, we were talking about,
right,
stab wounds. So tell us about that.
Right, right. Yeah, the wounds were, they were so expertly done, you know, it was almost like a professional, you know, assassin had done them. You know, when they did the autopsy, they saw that, you know, all of the wounds, that, and there were, both of them had, you know, up to a dozen stab wounds. They were all confined to the right side of the neck, kind of just below the jawline. And which is where the carotid artery and is located, and in fact in the autopsy they did find that in both victims the carotid artery and the jugular vein had both been completely severed, and which would be a very quick way to kill somebody and incapacitate somebody. And so the thought was, this, whoever did this knew what he was doing. Now, if we can look back now and say, well, obviously it was a doctor, and certainly that was thought, that was a possibility, which was one of the reasons that they looked hard into, or at least look to some degree at the folks that the hunters could identify who they had been associated with, but the hunters, the folks that they steered them onto, again, it just didn't take them anywhere.
Now, with this, pardon me?
Now, was there another part of that question? I think there was another part of that question earlier on, and I'm forgetting what that was now.
When police looked at it, did they see any indication that there was robbery or burglary involved?
Right, no, robbery, that was, the house was, nothing. There was nothing out of the ordinary. The only thing they found was a bunch of clothes. Tommy's room was a mess, but his parents said, that was Tommy. It looked like it had been ransacked, but that was not the case. And all around there were valuables that were completely untouched. It became pretty clear robbery was not the motive here.
Now, you introduced some other characters, obviously, very important to this, and that is Agendra and Chandra Butra, and they're also doctors in this pathology department as well. Tell us a little bit about this couple and what happens next.
Right. So, so 5 years later, the murders happened in March of 2008 in the Hunter home. Well, now we're in May 2013. In fact, it's Mother's Day, more than 5 years later. And there are a couple things happen. There's another doctor in the pathology department named, as you mentioned, Chandra Butra, who worked with Mr. Hunter and with another person who's going to become pretty important, the head of the department, which was Roger Brumback. She was off at a Mother's Day outing with her husband, and as they're approaching home, they find there's a burglar alarm has been tripped at their home. And so her husband, they get home minutes later, husband checks it out, finds that somebody had tried to force their way into the back of their home, had been rebuffed, unable to get in, and then an alarm had sounded and they had left. It took a while for police to put this together because the Butras did not originally report that attempted break-in. They didn't think it was a big deal. But 2 days later, police show up at the home of Dr. Roger Brumback, who, again, like I said, was the head of the Creighton Pathology Department and a colleague of both Bill Hunter and Chandra Butra. He and his wife were found murdered in their home. And Roger had been shot, but they had both also been stabbed to death. In fact, they'd been stabbed to death with knives that were taken from the home, stabbed in the right sides of their necks. And so this murder, these bodies are discovered 2 days after Mother's Day. And who is the first detective who walks in the door but Derek Moyse? And the same one who had been on the case 5 years earlier. And he's with a colleague named Scott Warner, and he right away starts noticing things that are very familiar to him. And the two victims, another immaculate home, no sign of burglary, both killed with knife wounds to their necks, although in this case the Roger Prumback, it appeared, had been initially accosted at the front door with a gun. The way that Derek Moyse pieced it together was Roger Brumback, someone showed up at the front door, accosted Roger, shot him. There was a struggle with Roger before the shots were let off, but the cartridge eventually fell out of the gun, but not before Roger had been shot. The assailant then took the gun and used it to batter Mary in the head, his wife. He proceeds to go and get knives from the kitchen, ends up in a horrible fight with Mary, where she's trying to fight off this man with a knife before she's subdued and just suffers very grievous wounds as she's trying to fight off this guy with the knife. And then after he killed Mary, he went over to Roger, who was also probably already dead. He'd been shot three times. But the assailant goes over to Roger, and just to make sure he's dead, he leaves that signature knife wound in the side of his neck. And so Moise recognizes this right away, and he doesn't think, oh my God, these cases are related, because you see some goofy things. But his antenna was up, and then shortly after he makes his first casing of the home, the police identify the victim to be Roger Brumback of the Creighton University Pathology Department, and all of a sudden things are starting to fall into place here.
At the crime scene, they find the gun, but there is a problem with this gun, and they also describe that as likely part of the reason in the subduing of Mary, that this gun has been broken. Tell us what kind of gun that they find there, at least the parts are, and again, this is important later in this trial.
Right, because the gun, there's no gun at the scene, but the clip is there. It fell right in the doorway where Roger was first assaulted, and then it was pretty clear when the person assaulted Mary with this now inoperable gun, which has no clip in it, when he struck her in the head, the gun broke, and because Derek Moise, who was kind of a gun nut, very quickly noticed the recoil spring and the rod and a piece of the frame that had broken off the front of the gun, which is what caused the other pieces to fall out. And so there were some gun pieces left behind, which the resident gun expert at the Omaha Police Department very quickly determines to be a Smith and Wesson SD9, and that does become important later on as Derek Moise and the task force attempt to piece together what's happened here.
You talk about the formation of this task force and this 12-person team, three, four-member groups. Tell us about this specific team Moise here with Derek Moise, and we mentioned Scott Warner. Tell us who the additional detectives are and their role in this team, task force.
Right. Yeah, because of the similarity of the earlier crimes, the chief decides they need to form a full task force. And there was actually about 20 members on it, and Derek Moise and the three detectives that were on his regular team in the Omaha Police Homicide Unit are both on the task force as well, along with there were even some detectives from other agencies to kind of give them a little extra manpower. But yes, so Derek was on the task force along with Scott Warner and the two other detectives that become pretty important are Ryan Davis and Nick Herford. And what happened was, so when the task force gets formed, Scott Warner had done a lot of work on the Russian. And so since the Russian had been in the pathology department, he all of a sudden becomes suspect number one again. And so Scott Warner gets back on the trail of the Russian. You know, does he have an alibi for these killings, as he seemed to the first time around? Davis and Herford, they have their roles. And Derek Moise has his initial role too, which was just to look into Mary Brumback, the wife, to see if there was anything in her background that you know, would anybody want to kill her. And that was his initial assignment, and he spent a week on it, you know, vetting Mary, talking to people who know her, you know, did she have any skeletons in her closet? It wasn't really a likely path to find this killer, but it was work that needed to be done. And it very quickly, you know, after doing about 7 or 8 of these interviews, Derek could see, you know, this isn't going anywhere. He goes to his sergeant, said, you know, this is a dead end. And the sergeant agrees, and he says, well, you know, there's a bunch of other guys that are going through the personnel records from Creighton. Because of the pathology department link between the two sets of murders, this time that rather than just talking to the hunters and some others about who they thought was suspicious, they pulled all the personnel records from the pathology department, from everyone who was working there or had worked there. And these folks were all, their records were put into individual binders. the sergeant says, you know, these guys are going through those records. Why don't I go and I'll get you one of those binders and you can work on that. And so the sergeant leaves and returns shortly thereafter with a binder, lays it on the desk of Derek Moise, and the name on the binder is Dr. Anthony Garcia. Again, another one of those cases where Derek Moise is just the right guy in the right place all the time in this case. He gets one binder out of the dozens that they had done, and it turned out to be the binder of the man who would become the prime suspect in these murders.
Now, you say that they have an idea of the connection with this pathology department, but they still have to go through, again, they have suspects. How do they get to Anthony Garcia and having the necessary corroborative evidence to be able to say, you know, because these police are exploring every lead, how do they come to the conclusion, Derek Moise and his team, that absolutely this is a person that is not just a person of interest, but the suspect?
All right. And he was not a person of interest when he picked up that binder. Even Dr. Bill Hunter, in his initial interviews after the second set of murders, still had not really put any kind of finger to Anthony Garcia. But he did finally mention that there was a couple of doctors who had been fired from Creighton many, many years earlier, back in 2001. This was even 7 years even before the Hunter killings. But he couldn't even remember the Garcia's name, that he had been one of those two who had been fired. So his profile had not been elevated at all to any degree. Derek Moise was really looking through a random binder at this point, and he starts reading it, and it's just a bunch of dry personnel records. But he very quickly realizes that, hey, this guy was fired. And there are some interesting things related to that. And he can see that part of the firing related to Butra, because he was having a big conflict with Butra, who was giving him bad reviews. Because what Anthony Garcia was he was a medical resident. He had come to Creighton in 2000 as a fresh medical school graduate, and who was looking to get certified in his specialty, which his chosen specialty here was pathology. So he was one of several new residents who was coming to go through what should have been 4 years of training at Creighton. And so Derek Moise quickly sees that, hey, he was fired. He didn't even make it a year in this thing. He had a conflict with Putra. And then he sees the letter the actual firing letter. And the two signatures at the bottom are Bill Hunter and Roger Brumback. And so he's like, wow, this guy has motive to kill everyone. And so it's just motive, though. He doesn't have any more reason to think that this is their guy. But he starts to look into the background of this Anthony Garcia, who he sees now lives in Terre Haute, Indiana. And in the process of that and getting some records from the folks in Terre Haute, he ends up getting a driving history, a vehicle registration history for Anthony Garcia, and it just pops off the page to him. This is like the 2 days after he first picked up Garcia's book, that Garcia, in March of 2008, was driving a silver Honda CRV, the same type of vehicle that had been seen outside the Hunter home. To him, this is like totally elevates this whole man to a new level. And he goes to his sergeant and he goes, I want Nick Herford, I want Ryan Davis. These are two guys on his regular homicide unit in OPD. And he goes, I want Nick and I want Ryan and I want you guys to leave us the heck alone. Because he kind of had a sense that they were on to their guy at that point.
Now, you say that, and each individual member, and we'll go through that, and you talk about Davis and have his unique abilities and being very young and enthusiastic, and then you called Herford the nerd cop, so he has his skills in this, and very, very interesting. what is the next step for police once they have this gleam of information, when Moyse decides that this guy should be, again, a person of interest? How do they proceed? What's next?
Right. So they know he has motive, but they don't know if he's had the opportunity, and they don't know if he has the means yet. And so the opportunity means to show that he was in Omaha in March of 2008, or that he was in Omaha in May of 2013, and that's what he and Nick and Ryan work on. But the other thing they do, so to do that, they request credit card records and phone records. And in the meantime, while they're waiting for those records to come in after they've made those requests, they look more into the background of Dr. Garcia, and it becomes very apparent to them that, yes, not only did this guy have motive, this guy had been very largely unsuccessful in his medical career, and it seemed like at critical moments, that firing that he had undergone from Creighton years earlier would come back to haunt him. And I guess we haven't mentioned what he was fired about, but he had been about 11 months into his pathology residency when he pulled a prank, essentially, on another resident who was taking a very high-stakes exam that was going to determine whether he was going to be certified as a pathologist, and basically called up the man's wife while he was taking this exam and said he needs to come to Creighton right away, and if he doesn't, he's going to be fired. And they eventually figured out who made this anonymous call, and that it was Dr. Garcia, and that's why he was fired. But he had been a complete misfit up to that point anyway, and was on his way to getting drummed out at the end of his first year, but because of this, he didn't even make it through the first year. They just said, you're gone now. And so this had come back to haunt him. And so they did a lot to fill in in fact, they found records that showed that he had been fired from another residency in early 2008 at LSU. And the reason the LSU people had fired him was because they had become aware that he had falsified his records when he applied for this LSU residency, and had indicated that he had completed a full year at Creighton and that he had never been disciplined, which they found to be false. And so they fired him. Well, Nick Herford is the one who's going through those records, and he realizes, holy cow, when you looked at the day that this guy was fired at LSU, it was almost 2 weeks to the day before the murders in the Hunter home. So it's all of a sudden, it's not like this guy was waiting 7 years to commit this. There was a much more immediate trigger that caused this to happen. And so they did more to establish motive. And so then it came time, to try to show, okay, he has the motive now, but can we show he was in Omaha? And the phone records they had requested from ATT for Garcia's cell phone, it took several weeks for them to come in. But when they came in, they were very excited to get them. They look at them, and they find on Mother's Day there was a single call in his call records. And it was a call that had gone unanswered. So he hadn't even answered the phone, but the records still showed that he had received a call that had gone to voicemail. And Nick Herford was the one who's going through these records. But the other guys were right over his shoulder because they knew this was a huge, moment. And so in the cell phone records, there were also a longitude and latitude number next to that call. Those were basically the location of the cell tower when that call was placed. And they saw the call had come in at 5 p.m. On that day, this would be on their timeline that they were working with, about an hour and a half after the Brumbacks were killed. And so they put in the latitude and longitude number, and there was a funny thing that happened before that, but I won't spoil. But they put it in, and bingo, a map comes up, and they see some stuff that's very familiar to them. The essentially, Garcia, when that call had come to his phone, was basically just a little more than an hour east of Omaha. And they were very excited because they knew, we got him now. We got him. I mean, this is, he's now not a person of interest. He is a, this is what makes him a full-fledged suspect. They now think they have the guy, but they still got to now set about to prove it.
Absolutely. We're going to use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about the sponsor today, Third Love. Using millions of real women's measurements, Third Love designs its bras with breast size and shape in mind for an impeccable fit and incredible feel. Third Love is the industry leader with 70 sizes, including its signature half-cup sizes. The details make the difference, from premium fabrics to expert design. Find your fit in 60 seconds with Third Love's online fit finder. Order and try on at home. No more awkward fitting room experiences. Hands down, the most comfortable bra you own. Tagless labels, no itching, straps that won't slip, ultra-soft, smoothing fabrics, and lightweight, super-thin memory foam cups. Third Love's team of expert fit stylists are dedicated to helping you find your perfect fit. If you don't love their product, returns and exchanges are free and easy. My wife Lisa received her classic T-shirt bra from Third Love. She was a bra fitter for 8 years. She said the cup shape was very, very flattering, and the bra extremely comfortable. The quiz to find the perfect bra for her really helped, she said. She loves her Third Love bra. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/true now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. We talked about the team with Derek Moyse and Scott Warner, Nick Hertford and Ryan Davis.
Right.
Now they have to put this completely together, make a PowerPoint presentation to the prosecution to be able to state their case, hoping that they have enough of evidence, that they've done enough work, and they can convince that prosecution to be able to take the next steps, to be able to capture him, arrest him, and successfully prosecute him. What does this team do next?
Right. It begins with those same phone records that they've just used to show that he was in Omaha the day of the, or near Omaha the day of the murders. Nick Herfert, he starts going through the records to try to determine who is he calling, to see if there's any other evidence in there that can helpful to them. And they notice that he had made a phone call to a place called Gander Mountain, which Gander Mountain didn't mean anything to Nick, but for Derek Moyse it did. He knew Gander Mountain was an outdoor outfitting store, and he also knew that they sold guns. And so seeing this call to Gander Mountain, again, it's just a hunch. I wonder if he could have bought a gun from Gander Mountain. So Ryan Davis goes out with a search warrant through the Indiana State Police to get the gun records from Gander Mountain. And they come back some days later. And sure enough, they show that not only had Anthony Garcia bought a gun from Gander Mountain in the spring of 2013, not long before Roger Brumback was killed. He purchased an SD9. Boom. Now they've kind of established the possible means, his possible means for committing these murders. And then they also got much better information by this time on where Garcia was, because as I mentioned, the detectives today use phone records and credit card records to try to place people at a certain place at a certain time. Well, Garcia was having huge financial problems. Part of the reason he went on this rampage was he was just kind of hitting the end of his line here. And so he had tons of credit cards that he'd had at various times and canceled and Moyse was the one who was going through the credit cards, and they were just very extensive, and he'd been going through these for weeks and wasn't getting anywhere. Well, finally, he got some credit card records from Regions Bank, and they had been slow coming in, and he had been begging them to he modified his request. He really wanted to get He didn't know if this card was the card, but all the other cards had shown nothing, and they got these records from Regions Bank, and they did show that around the time of the murders, there were a couple of credit card transactions that had taken place. One was in Omaha, Nebraska. It was at what Moise found to be a chicken wing restaurant. And then the other one was at a convenience store right across the river from Omaha in Council Bluffs, Iowa. It was a beer purchase that happened just a couple hours before the Brumbacks were murdered. So again, now they, in fact, not only did the convenience store have the sales record of that beer purchase, they had video. So they could now see video of Anthony Garcia driving up to this place right across the river from Omaha, going in and making his purchase. You know, he couldn't say, "Hey, somebody stole my credit card." So they felt that they could now conclusively prove that he was in Omaha at the time of the murders, and that's what made the task force finally and the prosecutor say, "Yeah, go get him."
Now you talk about that they had to have certain considerations to be able to capture him as well. That wasn't just a matter of thinking that he could go without a fight potentially. So they have to have plans in case something does happen. How do they finally make the capture of him? And is it sensational or not?
Yeah. With it, everything in this case, everything turns into a big event. And in this case, the task force flies into Indianapolis on a Sunday. They drive to Terre Haute, and the plan is to drive to Terre Haute and assemble with the Indiana State Police, and then early Monday morning before dawn, kick in his door and make the arrest. You know, they know this is a person who's killed four people, so they have to consider that he's dangerous. Well, they get to Indianapolis and they immediately see that, oh my gosh, he's on the move. They'd been pinging his cell phone. They'd been getting every half hour, getting an email from the cell phone company telling them the location of the cell phone. They could see that Garcia was on the move. In fact, he'd left Indiana, was on his in Illinois and was headed south. So they had to reassess their plan. So that once they arrived in Terre Haute, they decided that two FBI agents who were part of the task force would head south into Illinois, try to locate him and tail him and get on his tail, see what he was going to do. The hope was that he was just taking a little business trip or something and would be coming back to Terre Haute, but they had to prepare for the possibility that he was on his way. They didn't know where. Could he be working? Could he be fleeing? Had he learned about them? They didn't really know what had happened. And as it turned out, as we'll later find, it looks like he was on his way to go kill more people. So the FBI agents, they locate his car at a hotel and outside of town, a small town in off the interstate in Illinois, and they set up outside. There becomes a little bit of a snafu. Again, I don't want to get into all details of that, but essentially the next morning, he ends up leaving. Garcia leaves without them noticing. They go into panic mode and chase him down. They eventually do locate him, and then they're just tailing him. It's early in the morning. He's driving south. They don't know where he's going, and at this point, he's getting close to leaving Illinois and heading into Kentucky, I believe, is the state that borders there. And they, in downstate Illinois, at this point, they're like, "We can't allow him." It's very obvious he's not going back to Terre Haute, and we don't want him to leave Illinois because we're already engaged with the Illinois State Police here. Let's stop him before he hits the border. And so just about 30 miles before the border, and again, there's kind of interest, nothing, nothing just happens normally in this case, but there was kind of interesting how the arrest ended up going down too. But the state troopers do are able to make the arrest that morning, and they find that Garcia is drunk, completely drunk, and they take him in for a DUI. But he shortly after finds out that he's got way more problems than just a DUI on his hands.
What's incredible is what they find at the Terre Haute residence where Garcia was living. Tell us about what they find when they get in.
Right. This is where Nick Herfert and Ryan Davis are back in the story again, because they're the ones who are going to do the search warrant on his home while Moyse and Warner head south to try to interview Garcia. I mean, you can imagine how well that went. He lured up very quickly, but Davis and Herford are the ones who are going through the home, and you know, they see this they go to this very nice home in a nice neighborhood. It has a Ferrari parked in the driveway, you know, and it's all very pretentious, and they get in and then get inside, and it's a completely different picture. You know, outside you think, hey, this is the home of a successful doctor. They get inside, they find that there's almost no furniture in their place. There's not even a bed. There's an air mattress set out on the floor that Garcia was sleeping in. The place is a mess. Other than there are some records set out on the table in nice piles with, you know, all at right angles, kind of the important documents of his life. And in the sink, they find a kind of amateurish effort to destroy a bunch of documents. They had been put in the sink with some kind of chemical with the hope that would destroy them. But Davis and Herford pretty quickly see that some of them include some writings that appear to be pretty incriminating, talking about breaking into homes and covering up his fingertips, and they're like, I think we need to keep this stuff. And so they kind of, the scene they found in the home was just, frankly, just bizarre. And it's the first, as Herford later says, this is the first indications we got that not only we were dealing with a homicidal doctor, we were dealing with one that was kind of a little bit office rocker.
Absolutely. What they do in their investigation too is they go back, and as you include in your book too, they go into his entire background of his family life growing up, but more importantly, some of these psych evaluations and his interactions with medical staff along the way. What do they find in terms of some of those psych evaluations and what's contained therein?
Right. Some of that stuff didn't come along. Wasn't really revealed until a trial, what they learned, the detectives, while the Moyse and those guys were hitting Terre Haute, there were other detectives that head west out to California, which was where Garcia had grown up, and that's where they also knew the silver CRV was. His family still had it all these years later, 5 years after the Hunter murders, and so they are heading out there to impound the vehicle. But they also start interviewing his family, and they start interviewing people who know Garcia, and a kind of a narrative starts to emerge that Garcia was, he hadn't even really even wanted to be a doctor. It had never been his thing. He'd been kind of pushed into it by his family. He was academically probably not set up to do it. His IQ was average as could be. He had a reading disability, so he'd entered medical school reading at about a fifth grade level. If you can imagine what that would be like to try to get through medical school when you're reading at a grade school level. Now, I don't know what this says about our medical system, that he did get through medical school and even passed his exams. In some cases, it took a lot of extra effort. It took him an extra year to get through medical school, and he had to get special education accommodations, and it took him several tries to pass his board exams, but he did. He passed them. He became Dr. Garcia. But then to really be a successful doctor, though, you have to become then certified in a specialty. And what they found was that he failed miserably whenever he tried to do that. They learned that he had first, the Creighton pathology program that he was drummed out of, that wasn't even his first residency. They found there was another one even before that in New York, and that he had failed at based on his personality and just his ineptitude. And then the Creighton one had happened, and then he, even after Creighton, he had still landed in another residency in Illinois, and he'd failed at that one. And then the last straw was the fourth and final residency, which was the one that had happened in LSU. Now, despite the fact he didn't have a specialty, he was able to get work, you know, doing kind of health checks, you know, stuff that, you know, taking blood pressure, you know, going to a place of business, and you know, it wasn't lucrative work, but he was able to get some work. And the reason he was in Terre Haute was he was working at a prison, and was doing health care for prisoners. And as you can imagine, our prisoners must not get the finest of health care, because Dr. Anthony Garcia was one of the people who was caring for them at this federal prison in Indiana, rather. But even that eventually he just, it's very clear by the time shortly after he leaves Creighton, that he has some mental health issues. He was battling depression. And he landed after he bounced out of the LSU residency, or rather the Illinois residency in Chicago. He, in about 2003, ends up back home in California. He even thinks about becoming a car mechanic. And his parents said, you know, you don't have to do this doctor thing. But he somehow, between 2003 and 2007, after he thought about going to law school, thought about doing a lot of different things, he ends up back in psychiatry. And that's what the LSU residency was for. And it could be his own struggles with mental health was what had generated this interest in psychiatry. And so he failed in that one. He ends up back in, like I said, doing this work at this prison in Indiana. But then he loses that job too. And at this point, he's just in a real spiral. His mental health he has a lot of bizarre interactions with, law enforcement, nothing criminal, but just making calls to law enforcement saying that he was suicidal. He seems like he's constantly drunk. He shows up at workplaces drunk, and he's about to lose his home to foreclosure. He's just on this horrible downward spiral, and it's in the midst of that that the Brumback killings then occurred. And he had continued to spiral downward right up until the point he was arrested. And like I said, they would get evidence because not only would they find the evidence in Terre Haute and out in California that showed just what a downward spiral this guy was in, Derek Moyse and Scott Warner would find some pretty significant evidence in his car that he had been driving when he was arrested in Illinois, which included a sledgehammer, a crowbar, a new gun, and his old LSU lab coat taken out of mothballs, you know, by this point, it's more than 5 years after he's left LSU. And the interstate he was on was a road that would take you to Shreveport, Louisiana, which is where this health science center is located. It becomes pretty obvious to them he was on his way to kill again. And as we learn, once Nick Herford, post-arrest, begins his work in digital forensics, which is a really fascinating part of this case. We learned that these doctors at LSU weren't even probably his only intended victim still, that there were still others who were on Anthony Garcia's radar.
Yes, you talk about the work that Nick Herford does. He goes to Apple and he gets access to Garcia's account. He goes into his cloud account and downloads all the information that was on his phone, and he sees that everything, where he was eating, where he called from, all the GPS entries and coordinates. He also have the tablet. He also looked at the tablet. Most people wouldn't maybe do what he did with it, but on the tablet they found a lot of information and, like you say, plans for other doctors that he was going to enact revenge on.
I didn't know much about digital forensics until I talked to Nick and saw his work, and it's just fascinating. And all I can say, if you're a criminal and you carry a cell phone, you're an idiot, because the stuff that they were able to take off of Garcia's phone, they essentially were able to place him at the chicken restaurant, opening up Google and Googling Roger Brumback's address. And because we know that his initial target when he came to Omaha had actually been Butra, that we, as we know, that one had been foiled. And it wasn't that, and Nick was able to show that after within minutes after that failed attempt at Butra's, he sits down at a chicken restaurant. Apparently when he opened up Google Map and it said, Google would like to use your location services, and he said, yes, and he placed himself right there out at the restaurant when he Googled Roger Brumback's address. And so he's able to literally show him at the chicken restaurant plotting the killing of Roger Brumback right there. Finds lots of other incriminating stuff on the phone, stuff that he had, other searches for other victims, mapping locations to other victims' homes, trying to come up with other criminal ways to make money. Like you said, he's been in this spiral at the time, and the way that Nick finds it, you know, sometimes this is stuff that he's deleted from the phone, but that isn't enough to stop Nick. He has other ways of workarounds to find what he was looking for, and one of the last things Nick does is just makes a general search through the phone data for the word revenge, because the thought is that this was his motive. And sure enough, he finds that Brumback or Garcia had made a search on his phone for the words, "Shall I not revenge?" You know, which is a line from Shakespeare, actually, The Merchant of Venice.
You also talk about one last thing that they do just to I got to put the cherry on top of this sundae here, in that they find an innovative and novel way of trying to trace that gun or parts of that gun. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah, this is more than a year after Garcia's arrest now, but Derek Moyse is still working the case, and he's an obsessive guy. Derek, people are going to love Derek Moyse. He's just very interesting detective. He's very driven. He's very much his own guy. He has tattoos going all the way down his arms, and he's not necessarily a by-the-book. I mean, when it comes to his work, he's by-the-book, but he doesn't like to wear the department dress code, and his tattoos are often shown below his shirt sleeves, and he's a Buddhist, and he's a very interesting guy, but he's also very obsessive about his cases, and the fact that they had not found the gun continued to bother him. You know, they had the records that showed that he owned an SD9. They had some pieces of what appeared to be an SD9, but they didn't have the actual gun, and Moyse was bothered by this, and he was ready to contact every law enforcement agency between Omaha and Terre Haute to try to see if any of them had found the gun, because the idea was that he had likely ditched it somewhere between Omaha and when his return home to Terre Haute. But Warner kind of talked to him, and they were like, there has to be a better way to do this. And, you know, we don't have any good database on guns. The only database is one that you can search for. If you have a missing or lost gun, you can search to see if anyone has turned it in. Well, and that wasn't like the gun Moyse knew wasn't likely to be in there because Garcia would never report that gun missing or lost. But Warner had this idea that's like, well, what if we searched the searches? What if there were? What would we do if we were a law enforcement agency and we found this gun? Well, we would run it through this database to see if it was lost or stolen. So Warner had this idea, well, can we search the searches to see if anybody has ever searched for this gun? Because if they have, it's an indication they might have it. And the technician in the department said, well, that's not really what we do, but, you know, she said, I'll see if it's possible. And sure enough, Moyse gets an email from her the next day saying, hey, there was one other search that was in Omaha and Clark County in Illinois, and gives them the phone number, and he calls them, and sure enough, a matter of months after the Brumback killings, there was a guy, and it's kind of a funny story, that had found the gun right along the side of the road in Illinois, not far from Terre Haute. And so, you know, Garcia was no criminal mastermind. You know, there's probably a million different ways he could have ditched that gun. But in this case, he had just dropped it by the side of the road. And because of that, and because of this just doggedness of Derek Moise, you know, they were able to find the gun.
Let's fast forward to the trial, October 3rd, 2016, it arrives and it begins. In that interim, they found somebody that would help them with the more difficult part of this case. They put all four murders together, even though they were 5 years apart. The murders of Tom Hunter and Shirley Sherman were more difficult and more circumstantial.
Right.
In this
right.
book, almost fiction-like, a person comes to be the star witness, and her name is Cecilia Hoffman. Tell us a little bit about
right.
the emergence of Cecilia Hoffman and its significance to this case.
Yeah, she's first of all, just to tell you about this trial. This trial was the most sensational trial in the state of Nebraska since Charles Starkweather in 1959, and because these murders have been so high profile, and even when there have been big murders, they typically wouldn't often go to trial, and Garcia did. He took his case to trial. There were four murders. Obviously, they had him pretty much nailed on the Brumback killings. They had the weapon. They had him placed in Omaha with the credit card and the phone records. They had obviously all kinds of motive. That was a pretty slam dunk case on those killings. But the Hunter killings, it was more problematic. They had the similarity between those killings and the Brumback killings. So, you know, that's the reason they tried them together. They hoped that they could use the much stronger evidence in the Brumback case to help convict him of the Hunter killings. But they had the fact that he drove a silver CRV and that he was olive skin like millions of other people out there. So that was all they had, and they didn't have anything else. They weren't able to ever get anything that placed him in Omaha. You know, this was 5 years after the fact by the time they identify him. So they don't have much of it's a very, very thin and circumstantial case they have in the Hunter killings, except for one thing. Davis and Herford, after they do the search of the home in Terre Haute, they're interviewing people in the orbit of Anthony Garcia, and they learn about his affinity for strip clubs. And through that, they learn about Cecilia Hoffman, who was a stripper who had a bit of a relationship with Anthony Garcia. It wasn't the kind of a relationship he wanted. She was just using him to get this big spender to spend money on him. He had taken a true interest in her, and they there was talk that Cecilia had something to say about what Garcia and something he had said to her. And so Nick and Ryan track her down, and you know, they weren't sure whether she'd be credible. You know, she is a stripper after all, but she sits down with them, and they find her to be very honest, very straightforward, gets very emotional as she talks about what had happened. And she mentioned that, yeah, there was a time when Garcia told her that he had once killed, quote, a young boy and an old woman. And, I mean, it was tantamount to a confession, you know, of the killings in Omaha in 2008. And there were all kinds of court fights as to whether this was going to be admissible or not, but it prevailed, and she became by far the star witness at trial because she is represents the most telling evidence linking Anthony Garcia to the killings of Tom Hunter and Shirley Sherman in 2008.
It's interesting that you include the conversation. So you just mentioned that he had admitted to her, but how? What kind of crazy conversation would come up? So tell us about the conversation that elicited this.
Right. As I said, the relationship was kind of a one-way relationship. It was a business relationship for Cecilia, but Garcia, she was stringing him along for the money, but he was truly interested in her, and he was starting to get kind of weird, and so she finally, it's a business thing. I need to break this off and let one of the other dancers take over because he's trying to get too personal, and so she, outside the club, during a smoke break one night, she said, it's time, and she said, Dr. Tony, it's really not going to work with us because you're a good guy, you're a doctor, and I'm a bad girl. And he goes, well, I'm not such a good guy. In fact, I've killed people. And so the reason he admitted to it was he thought he was going to impress her that, I don't know, I'm a bad guy too, so we can be together. And that's when he made this admission to her. And she kind of dismissed it at the time, didn't think much of it. And it wasn't until Nick Herford and Ryan Davis sat down with her for the first time that she realized, wow, holy cow, this really did happen. And
now,
her trial...
go ahead.
And so, like I said, she becomes the most sensational witness at trial, and when people read that part of the book, I mean, her testimony is sensational, and it is... And it produces some. So she, let's just say she turns out, despite the defense's efforts to impugn her integrity, she turns out to be a great witness. And there are some very, very dramatic moments that occur at trial because of that.
Absolutely. You talked about that normally that there is and even though it's an adversarial system where it looks like they're in competing against each other. But this one looked like all-out combat.
Tell
us just a little bit about the motto team, and really when you characterize it as the kind of the defense that you normally don't see. Why is that? What was it about their defense that you just normally don't see?
Right. Yeah. This was the prosecution Anthony Garcia was defended by a team called the Matas. It was a father, son, and wife combination, and they were from Chicago, and they didn't really care what anybody in Omaha thought about them, and they took a very as even Mata referred to it during a court hearing I was attending one day, he said, we can afford to take a scorched earth policy because we don't practice here normally. And so they just, everything was combative, and they were fighting the prosecutor on everything. And Mata, the younger Mata, male in particular, was just had a fiery temper, and he would just lose it in hearings. He'd start yelling, and this was also going on at trial. And in fact, the most climactic moment in the trial features a moment when he's yelling at the top of his voice at Cecilia Hoffman as she's sitting there on the stand. Like I said, this case had everything. I mean, nothing about this case was ever normal, and that includes her right up to the point he's at trial.
This is a death penalty case, and at the same time, you talk about all the attendance that's there. Bill Hunter doesn't show up. Dr. Bill doesn't show up because he has PTSD as a result of finding his son and the homemaker. So his wife goes. She attends. And you also have all of the people that attended. Tell us the cast that attends this from the family members, and then tell us what happens at trial.
Right. So I got to know the Hunter family pretty well as a result of working on this book, and they are a remarkably strong couple. They actually still live in the same home where their son was killed, and And you might think, how could they do that? And it has to do with A, they are just very strong people, and B, they said, you know, this is where our memories were. You know, we raised three boys in this home, and, you know, they, to them, this wasn't the home where their youngest son was killed. This is the home where this family had just created, you know, decades of memories as the boys were growing up. So Claire Hunter is very strong, and she is at trial every day. She wants to see and hear it all. With Bill, you know, he had suffered for PTSD for a year after. You know, you can imagine what it's like to walk into your home and find your son with a knife in his neck. And so it had been very difficult for him. But I will say this, even though he stayed away from the trial, he had to testify at trial. He had to testify about finding his son. And he had to, and then he came back again to tell the very long history that he had with Anthony Garcia and what had happened back in Creighton in 2000 and 2001 that led to the firing. And Bill was very, very, very strong witness at trial, but because of the concerns about PTSD, he wasn't going to sit there through the coroner's reports or anything like that. But his wife did. You know, she was a very strong person. Also at the trial every day were Shirley Sherman's family. You know, we haven't talked much about Shirley or really any of the victims, and that's one of the things I love about Pathological. We're able to go deep into the backgrounds of the victims here so people can see what was lost and who was lost. And it wasn't just the promise of an 11-year-old boy who was gifted and very smart and was bound for great things. It was, you know, Shirley Sherman was, you know, she was kind of the glue of her family, and she had sacrificed a lot in her life for her family and to keep her family together, and as a single parent and caring for an elderly mother, and two of her brothers and her son were both also regulars at trial every day, kind of in honor of you know, just this family matriarch that had been lost. And of course the Brumbacks were, you know, they were wonderful people too, and Roger, very successful doctor, and Mary, just a very compassionate, giving person. So those victims' family, the Brumbacks did generally stayed away from the courtroom, but the Waite family and Claire Hunter, they were there every day, and it led to a kind of a neat scene once the verdict finally came down, where you had a room where the prosecutors, the victims' families all gathered right after the verdict. Generally, it's a meeting that is typically held where the prosecutors tell them, okay, here's what happens next. You know, there'll be a sentencing hearing. You know, it's really more just an informational thing. But in the end, the task force detectives, including Derek Moise and Nick Herford and Warner, they all end up coming into this room too. And so here, gathered in one place, you have all of the significant players, from the detectives who cracked the case to the prosecutors to the families of the victims. They're all gathered in one place, and it's kind of a neat scene that takes place kind of right after the conviction comes down from the jury.
What is the conviction from the jury? How long did it take for them to come to their verdict?
It was not long at all. The number 7 hours is sticking in my head, they only deliberated for the better part of one day. You know, there were four murders here, so there was a lot to go through. But they did, even though Derek Moise was worried right to the very end, because that's just the kind of person he is. They did get four murder convictions, and everything about this case was protracted. I don't know if we noted that not only did it take 5 years to find him, it took another 3+ years for him to go to trial, and it took another almost 2 years for him to be sentenced. Everything about this case just dragged on and on and on. But finally, earlier just this very year, he was finally sentenced, and he was sentenced to death. Of course, we know that doesn't mean anything in our system today. He has years and years of appeals ahead of him, and the last execution that was done here in Nebraska, we just did have one this year, but it was a guy who had killed two cab drivers in the 1970s. So it shows you how long this appeal. I would be shocked if he actually ends up seeing a death sentence, but there's no question he's never going to see the light of day again.
You talk about about the status of Derek Moise after this, what he becomes, but also very, very interesting, you alluded to it, a very unusual response in the courtroom. I've seen cases where the jury were hugging members of the family. In this case, what happened was unusual. Tell us about that, and tell us what the status of Derek Moise was as a result of this and afterwards.
Right, yeah. Derek, you know, like you said, the book begins with Derek Moise, and there's a reason for that, because he just becomes the principal character, you know, throughout this. He's a real-life guy, and nothing fictional about him, but because of the fact that he was just there for every critical moment, and that included right up until the time of the verdict, and he kind of felt the need to be in the courtroom at the time of the verdict. This case was very personal to him. He had had visions of Tom in his sleep at times because this case just had gnawed at him so much. And so it was meaningful for him to be in the courtroom that day. And he's not a lot of guy who is comfortable with a lot of attention, but he was in the room with the families after the verdict, and they were obviously very grateful. And it did turn him into kind of a bit of a celebrity. You know, a couple of the networks did magazine-style documentaries on the case. And he was prominently featured in those, but he remains a homicide detective in Omaha today, still very dedicated to his work, but he would tell you this is a case that will live with him forever.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Pathological, the Murderous Rage of Dr. Anthony Garcia, Henry J. Cordes. This is a Wild Blue Press release. Is there a website, Facebook page? How can they take a look at this book or other work? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it becomes available on Wednesday, December 19th, and people will find it. If you just Google Pathological, you can order it through Amazon. The World Herald, which is where I'm located, we're selling them directly from our website as well, and the Kindle version will be out, and there'll also be a audio book version of it. So however people like to get their true crime, they can do it. Just look for Pathological.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Henry J. Cordes. Fantastic book, Pathological, and thank you very much for this interview. You have a great evening.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Good night.